You're listening to Lucid Cafe. I'm your host, Wendy Halley. The season of the wolf here at Lucid Cafe. If I didn't know better, I'd say the wolves are trying to get our attention, and they sorely need it. Today, I speak with my friend and fellow shamanic practitioner, Barbara Morich, about her new shamanism-inspired novel, Wolf Time. Before retiring, Barbara worked in the U.S. National Park Service as a ranger naturalist and ecologist in Sequoia, Kings Canyon, Death Valley, and Yosemite National Parks, and Point Reyes National Seashore. She's worked as a consulting botanist, an environmental education instructor, and a wildland firefighter. Barbara is also the author of The Soul of Yosemite, Finding, Defending, and Saving the Valley's Sacred Wild Nature. Please enjoy my conversation with Barbara Morich. Well, Barbara, it is great to reunite with you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's great to see you again.
Yeah, it's been a while. So just to let folks know, we were in training together, did some advanced shamanic training back, well, the last time we saw each other was in 2012. So congratulations on your new book.
Thank you.
Wolf Time. What a great title. Let's just dive right in. What do you mean by wolf time?
Wolf time is a situation where a person meets wolf. In this case, it's Sage McAllister, the protagonist in the novel, meets some wolves and discovers that she can communicate with the wolves telepathically. And she's surprised when one of the wolves nips at the back of her neck and sends her into basically a time travel experience. And she merges with the wolf and starts to see the world through the eyes of that wolf. And that's entering wolf time.
Okay. So it's akin to dream time, only it's the place where the wolves dwell.
Yes.
In the dreaming.
Yes.
But I love it.
It's not really dreaming. It's really happening in the novel. She is actually merging
right
with the wolves. And they land in various places in the recent past to show Sage what their lives were like and some of the experiences that they had.
Very cool. So what inspired you to write this book?
Good question. I was not writing about wolves when this came about. I was writing a novel about the Plains Indians Wars. And I was writing specifically about the Little Bighorn. And the writing of that novel was based in my shamanic experiences, shamanic journey work. I had things coming to me that felt like they were important enough to put together in a story. So I was doing research in South Dakota and North Dakota, up in the Black Hills area, and the Little Bighorn area in Montana. And I ended up in a town called Custer, South Dakota, and was walking down the street, very small town, and it's the southern end of the Black Hills. And I noted that there was a shop front down the street that had a wooden deck with a railing, and over that railing was a bison hide. And I saw that bison hide, and I was pulled into it. And so I was with my husband, Tom, and we walked down. I said, I need to check this out. Well, it turned out to be a store that or a shop that sold all animal parts all the time. You could buy any kind of skin or teeth or claws or, and in all of my past experience in my life, I would have been completely repelled by this kind of shop. I would have had nothing to do with it and got nowhere near it. But I was compelled to go in. And when I left, I had the bison hide and two wolf pelts that I purchased. So, completely out of character. I don't know what, it just felt as if something was directing me to do this. So I got these guys home and I thought, now what do I do? You know, so we have a sofa and we have a recliner chair then next to the sofa that I used when I was writing. It was in the living room, good light, you know, had the music, and I'd sit there when I wrote. So I put the bison over the couch and put the wolves on top of the bison and just sat with it. And almost immediately, I started downloading a story. It was clear that I was having to write about the wolves before I could write about the little bighorn.
Okay, so you switched from writing one novel to writing a different novel altogether.
Yes.
And that is Wolf Time.
That's Wolf Time.
So it sounds like it was a really powerful experience. I was actually wondering, as I was reading it, I was thinking about your ability as a shamanic practitioner, how much of it was informed by your practice.
A great deal of it. And I would sit in my chair and I'd put R. Carlos Nakai flute music on, and I would drift and I would journey. And they were telling me their story. And I just wrote, you know, I just was the one that put the pieces together. The story came very easy, but then once it was written, things got challenging. Because I had decided, I wrote my first book, The Soul of Yosemite, and I self-published it with the help of a friend. This book, I decided to spend a little time looking for a publisher or an agent, because most major publishers won't let you submit a manuscript unless you have an agent. It has to go through an agent.
Right.
So I spent a little time looking around, didn't have any success, decided to do it myself, went back to the same person I'd worked with before who was in New York. And he was transitioning out of helping writers produce their books. So he passed it off to his brother. His brother did not do a very good job with trying to get the format laid out. So I pulled back a little bit. And at that point in time, I got an email from Jane Goodall. And Dr. Jane...
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I sent her a letter probably 10 or 11 months previous. I sent her a letter and just told her about the book and asked if there was any, you know, if she had any interest in looking at the manuscript and maybe writing me an endorsement. I figure you're not going to win unless you play. And so I'm willing to throw those things out there whenever I can. And I didn't hear anything back for 11 months. So I thought, you know, got the circular file, that's fine. But then I got an email from her, and it says, from Jane's personal email, please do not share. And I thought somebody was doing something to play games with me. I didn't think it was real, but it was. It was from Jane. And she said the book sounded really interesting, and she imagined I'd published it by now, and congratulations. And I was like, wait, stop the presses. No, I haven't published it yet. So I sent her a note back, and I said, if there's any chance that you'd be interested in reading it, it would be wonderful. And she said, okay, send me the manuscript. I'm on my way to the Paris Climate Talks, and I'll read it on the plane. And she did, and she wrote back, and, you know, she read it within about 2 days, wrote me back, said, you know, there's one small change that I would make in the way that the wolves are communicating. And, of course, Jane Goodall says, you change something, you do. So I did. And then I thought, well, now I really need to get serious about finding a publisher. You know, no luck. Worked at it. Tried to find an agent. Worked at it. No luck. Decided to do it myself. And then a friend sends me this email and says, you know, my new neighbor here in New Mexico has a small publishing company, and he's an agent, and he said he'd be willing to look at your manuscript. So, okay, back and forth with him. This was 2017, May of 2017. And I'd gotten the email from Jane in November of 2015. So this is 5 years ago. And the manuscript was ready before that.
Wow.
So my friend's friend said, yes, we'll represent you. And he worked for 2 years and was unable to find a publisher. And what we kept hearing back from them was, it's not clear if it's adult fiction or young adult fiction. And we don't know how to shelve it in the bookstores. And I thought that was actually a strength of the book, is that it transcends those two categories and embraces
it. Appeals to a wide audience.
Right, and that's the whole reason I ended up wanting to write it as fiction, is because I wanted to reach a broader audience and educate people about what wolves are about and hopefully gain some new advocates for protection. So anyway, didn't find anybody. So finally, last year, 2019, December, I told my agent I was going to take it back, do it myself. And this is kind of the trials and tribulations of being a writer. But then COVID hit. And I thought, well, crap. I can't do readings and signings. I'll do all my marketing online. So I decided I was going to just drop it for the moment. And then the voice said, no, don't drop it. Do it. Do it right now. And the interesting thing is I published in August of this year. And in just this past October, late October 29th, the Fish and Wildlife Service announced that wolves were delisted, no longer on the endangered species list in the lower 48 states. So the timing was perfect, as it usually is when you're patient with it.
So the timing was perfect.
And it usually is when you're patient.
Yes, it's quite a journey you went through.
It was.
I mean, I don't think you're alone in that. Those of us who've written books, it's an interesting time. The publishing industry has changed so much since I had my kids' book released back in 2003. Self-publishing was looked down upon, and now it's like this huge industry. And if you know how to market yourself, then you can do really well as a self-published author.
Yeah.
So it's open to anybody now.
It is. And there's also a number of resources out there to help you do that. So I hired a woman who lives in Austin because I don't want to jump through all the hoops. I don't want to deal with the formatting and the layout and getting it to the printer and, you know, the proofing. Yeah, I have to do the proofing. But getting it up on Amazon and Barnes & Noble sites, getting the distributor, Ingram, lined up, and doing all the legwork on that. I didn't want to do that. And so I hired someone to help me jump through all those hoops. And then I hired another someone to help me with marketing. And it's all online right now. So learning all the social media platforms, which I tend to, you know, I do Facebook and I'm happy with Facebook and I really don't want to do anything else, but I've had to branch out.
Yep. That's what we do now.
It is. Do
we do the social media stuff, even if we think it's stupid. I'm revealing a bit of myself there. So I can't imagine what it must have been like to open your email box and see an email from Jane Goodall's private account.
Yeah.
Holy crap.
I was dancing.
Yeah, that's like astounding. That's what I had seen. I had seen the blurb from Jane Goodall in a Facebook post. And I was like, holy shit, how did she pull that one off? That's pretty amazing. You just took a chance.
Yeah.
It's a good lesson for all of us out there in the world. Take
Indeed.
A chance. Yeah.
And Jane she's doing everything in her power to try to support people who are advocating for wildlife and wild spaces. She's just a gem. She's remarkable, really.
Yeah, she's a hero.
Yeah.
No doubt about that.
I was just back in contact with her too, because I wanted to send her a signed copy, you know, and this is 5 years later, Jane, we finally made it, got the book. And so I dropped her an email and she, congratulations. And she gave me her address and she said, she's in lockdown. So send it to me in, you know, the UK. And so that's, yeah, it's been really fun.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. So this unusual story, I mean, I love the concept of it. I love the concept of this very shamanic, which is not common in fiction, to have a really purely shamanic storyline, at least at this point. But this idea of your protagonist kind of straddling two worlds, the world that we all are familiar with, the ordinary world, physical reality, and then the world that the wolves inhabit, and then how she gets there with the nip on the back of the neck. That's a really cool. So I'm curious, you had let slip a little while ago, you had decided to write this as fiction. So would you mind going into that a little bit more? Like, what did you mean by that? That suggests that it could have been nonfiction.
It could have been. And had I decided to go with it nonfiction, it would have been more along the lines of telling the story of how I was writing a different book and the wolves came into my life, the wolf pelts came into my life, and the communication that followed. So that would have been the way the book would have been introduced. And I think part of the reason I chose to do it as fiction also was because there's still a lot of people out there that don't have any kind of grasp of shamanic practice. And again, I wanted to try to appeal to the broadest audience I could. And I actually had attended a workshop, a woman named Alexandra Fuller, a writer from, I believe she was raised in Rhodesia before it was Zimbabwe. And she writes memoir primarily. And I did a workshop with her over in Sun Valley a number of years ago when I was first starting to really write this. And we each had a little bit of one-on-one time where she had read a piece that we'd written and we'd talk about it. And I said, the one thing, she said, I can't really tell you anything about craft. You've already got that down. But, you know, do you have questions for me? And I said, the one question I have is, how shamanic should I make this? Hmm. And she said, full on. And that was sort of what opened it up and released it for me to do that, was her just saying, just go for it. Now, the downside is, again, the mainstream publishers don't know what to do with it because it doesn't fit into any genre.
I'm familiar with that issue, yeah.
It's not a crime, it's not a thriller, it's not romance. It's what they call magical realism, which is a genre, but it's not selling right now. It's not, unless it's Harry Potter, it's not, or true fantasy. If it straddles the real world and is magic, there's not much out there that's selling. That posed a challenge for the book too.
Yeah, no, I could see that.
I can read you a few passages.
Sure. Why don't you read a little bit from your novel?
Yeah, I got a review from the Midwest Book Review people, who they're pretty prominent book reviewer. And the reviewer chose to excerpt a piece of Wolf Time. And I thought that was interesting because I don't know that I would have done that, even in a reading signing event, you know, where I would be pulling passages out to read. And what I will do is read that to you, the one she pulled out. I'll just read her little paragraph.
Okay.
So this is Midwest Book Review. Reviewer says, perhaps the most moving parts of the story lie not in Sage's realizations, but in the wolves' assessment of human impacts on the planet and what must be done to open their eyes. Quote, in response to what we understand is a difficult time for humans on Earth, select members of the animal network, as well as members of various elemental networks, like the fire and water networks, are becoming more vocal and more visible to try to show humans that there are other ways to live. It's time for humans to take a huge step forward in their evolution. And one of the first tasks at hand is to develop reverence for all the other than human beings on the planet, the other animals, the plants, the rocks, the rivers, and lakes, as well as the objects you craft from these entities in order to survive.
Beautiful. That's high praise. I bet your hair was standing on end when you got that one too, huh?
It's a good review. Yeah.
It's like a big exclamation point at the end of your process, right? To get that kind of praise. And the messages from the wolves in the book are very poignant. I mean, I've come to the conclusion that deception is the biggest issue we face. I remember saying this when we met in 2012, and it didn't go over very well when we were doing all of our introductions at the shamanic training. We were going around and I said, I've come to the conclusion that I think we're all full of shit. I think varying degrees of shit. And some of us are trying to be less full of shit, but that we are all full of shit. What I mean by that is that deception is our biggest issue. And the reason why I say that is because I think that the first lie that a large portion of the human race told itself was that we're separate from nature, that we're somehow better. And then everything sort of snowballs from there. I really think that was kind of like the birth of colonialism in a big way, and just how we've slipped out of relationship with the natural world and all of its inhabitants. And a lot of the messages in your book, I really resonated with because of that.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it seems to have come to a real head right now.
Oh, you think?
Politically and socially, and not just ecologically and environmentally, but across the board. And not only, I mean, you know, we could go on and on, but not only are humans better, more important, and separate from the rest of creation, white humans are separate and better than the rest of creation.
Yep, that's pretty much it. Yep.
It's very interesting to me that some of the messaging that I got from the wolves had to do with the wolves' role on the planet.
Yeah, I love that. Go ahead and tell me a little bit about that.
That they are here in part in relationship with humans to expose the dark underbelly of humanity and human nature, and to bring forth the anger and the vitriol and the just all the dark side of human nature. And the idea being that that all has to be exposed before it can be healed or it can be transmuted. And that that's a big part of their role. One of them said, well, yeah, we drew the short straw. And so that's part of what we're here to do. And it's very clear, because wolves have been scapegoated from time immemorial as, you know, the big bad wolf, and they're going to eat your livestock and your children at the bus stops. And that hasn't gone away. And I really think that it's also representative of people's anger at their lives. They'll take it out on something. Well, maybe not my wife or my kids, or maybe my wife and kids too, but I need to take out my anger at something. And so they target the wolves, and they have for a long time. And then of course there's the people that just are the thrill killers and just trophy killing for fun.
Yeah, that's really heartbreaking. No, the human race is not very highly evolved.
No.
We have a lot of work to do, which is probably part of the reason why we come here to this planet. It's rich with opportunity to evolve when we bump up against other creatures.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of opportunity. How are we going to be in those moments?
Mm-hmm.
Not the easiest place to be. I've said that in other episodes, and I guess I keep saying it. So, yeah, it is fascinating how wolves have been depicted. They've gotten a really bad rap.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. For a very long time. And the irony is, you know, I don't remember the exact, let me take a quick peek, but the irony of that is that most people have dogs in their life.
I know. I was thinking about that.
And that was another message that I can give you direct. I'll do a little short reading. The irony of humans' anger at wolves and the way wolves have been persecuted for decades, centuries, actually. It's the irony is that most people have dogs in their homes, living with them, sleeping on their beds, eating their food, keeping them company. And one of the encounters that Sage has with one of the wolves, who happens to be a ghost wolf named Snow, she had crossed over and came back to merge with Sage and take her into a different part of wolf time. And Snow said, well, actually Sage said, I know we are witnessing some of the relationships between early humans and wolves, but why? And what had happened is Snow had done wolf time journeys with Sage, showing her a couple of times in the early past when wolves and humans started to come together and form the relationship that led to the domestication of dogs. So I know we're witnessing some of the relationships between early humans and wolves, but why? A couple of reasons, said Snow. One is so you could see humans and the wolf ancestors came together in relationship at many times and many places in history, as well as what you call prehistory, for various reasons. Second, there are about 1 billion domestic dogs on Earth right now, and every one of them is related to the wolf ancestors. Dogs are man's best friend. They guard their humans' homes and families, help with hunting, find people who are lost, provide aid to people who are blind or otherwise unable to cope with life alone. They keep people warm and provide an unsurpassed quality of companionship. Every one of these dogs has wolf inside. Genetically speaking, 98.8% of the DNA in wolves and dogs is identical. Despite this close kinship, however, wolves continue to be persecuted and defiled in the worst ways. This makes no sense to us. No sense at all.
No, it doesn't make any sense. I was just thinking about how wolves seem to be coming into the foreground a little bit, at least on my podcast, talking to you. And then I also talked with an author of a book called Winter of the Wolf. And it's also it's not quite as shamanic as your book, but it definitely flirts with that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a YA book. The author has an incredibly powerful relationship with wolves, and actually she does wolf conservation work in New York outside of the city.
Okay.
And you can go and visit the wolves.
Is it like a rescue center?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're trying to replenish the wolf population. Yeah. So it's interesting that I'm talking to two people this season so far about wolves. And I guess it's just interesting.
When I started to think about needing to market this book, I started to look in Facebook for different groups that were for wolf advocacy. And there are dozens, if not hundreds of them, with tens of thousands of members interested in wolves. And the sad part to me, I mean, this is great to have this much support and interest, but when you talk to various wildlife management agencies and entities, like at the state level or at the federal level, they dismiss a lot of those wolf advocates and wolf lovers as keyboard warriors, basically saying that they don't have any understanding of what wolves are really all about, and they don't know that wolves, you know, brutally kill livestock, and that they are, you know, a lot of the agencies will claim, well, they're decimating the deer population or the elk population, and therefore the hunters don't have as many animals to shoot. So there's still that mentality in the wildlife agencies, and most of them are loaded with hunters. And any wildlife commission, state level, like the Idaho State Wildlife Commission, which makes a lot of the decisions on directions that wildlife management is going to go, are all hunters. And they're so biased, and they have such a vested interest, personal interest in wanting to kill things, that to be able to shift that to a more compassionate approach is like trying to freshen the ocean.
Yeah. I was just thinking that the understanding of wolves is really inaccurate. I think that in general, that there's just a lack of genuine understanding of how wolves really operate. Because I guess the research has been based on wolves in captivity. They present very differently in captivity than they do in the wild.
Mm-hmm.
It's, at least my understanding is, they're not really the kind of monsters that they're depicted as.
No, they're not. Not by any stretch. No, they're out to make a living just like any other animal. And yeah, they'll take a cow or a calf. They'll take a sheep or a lamb.
Well, so will we.
Right. Well, that's it. It's a competitor. And I think that's a large part of the reason there's so much animosity towards the carnivores, the non-human carnivores, the ones we call predators. And that name really has to go away too, because it's misused. But we're competing with them in our perception, the human perception. You know, we're competing with them when, in fact, no, we're not. We can coexist. There are ways. And yet it does seem like we're going rapidly in the wrong direction with this recent delisting, taking wolves in the lower 48 off of the endangered species list as of just a couple weeks ago. It'll go into effect in January. Number of the states had already gained control of the wolf populations: Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, I think Washington and Oregon as well. The management of the wolf populations had been turned over to the states. And at least in Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho, it turned into a massacre. They estimate that Idaho had about 1,000 wolves when they did the latest census in 2019. And it's hard to count wolves. Clearly, it's hard to count any of these big wild animals.
Yeah, I bet.
That was their population estimate. And in between July 1st, 2019 and June 30th of this year, they killed about 60% of those wolves. 60%. And so what's going to happen is when the management's turned over to the states are going to allow trapping and shooting of as many wolves as possible right up to that limit where they would have to be listed again. So if the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says, Idaho, you have to maintain 300 wolves, if they stay at that level and they shoot 600 wolves every year, then the animal won't be relisted. So it's just this constant cycle of killing.
Mm, it's freaking heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking, and it's absolutely without any merit at all. I understand if you get a wolf that comes in and starts taking someone's cows or sheep over and over and over, maybe you do need to target that animal, but you don't go and take out the whole pack. And you don't allow trophy hunters to come in for the thrill kill and kill hundreds of animals. And then you do your absolute best to keep that livestock away from the wolves. You know, right now we're trying to keep the wolves away from the livestock. No, it's backwards. It's backwards. And it has been for most of our environmental issues when you sit right down and look at it. You know, if Joe Pipeline Company wants to put a pipeline in somewhere, he writes an environmental impact statement, and the environmental groups go out and they review it, and the burden of proof is on the environmental groups to say, no, this is not safe, this is not sound, this is not environmentally sensitive.
That's a little backwards, huh?
It's all backwards. And almost every single environmental issue you can look at, we're framing it backwards. We're not framing it from a perspective of it's most important to protect. We're framing it from the argument that it's most important to make money.
So it's hard to be optimistic about the future for wolves, isn't it?
It is hard to be optimistic. I was recently asked to write a little op-ed piece for the Center for Biological Diversity, which is one of the better organizations that's working on behalf of the wolves. And they're putting together a group of op-eds on what the Biden administration should do for various issues, on various issues. How should they address wildfire? How should they address climate change? How should they address wolves? And they asked me to put together an op-ed piece on wolves. So I'm looking forward to that. And the gist of it, in my mind, is not only do we have to relist them, because they have not recovered. They've recovered maybe in 10% of their historic range. That's not recovered.
That's not very much, yeah.
No, and turning it back over to the states, again, it's just going to be a hunting massacre. So that's not recovered.
I don't know how somebody can see a wolf in the wild and raise a gun and shoot it. I don't understand. Maybe because I have three dogs at home. I mean, I can't imagine raising a gun and, not that my dogs are wolves, but they're in the same family. How could you, there's no dissonance there. There's no, it just doesn't.
There's total dissonance. That's the problem. There's no compassion. There's no sense that this is another life that has a family. And
is it like selective psychopathy?
There you go.
Where you have no empathy for wolves.
Right, or for elephants, or for rhinos.
I was just going to say, and there are other animals as well.
Yeah,
probably most animals.
Most animals, and you know what, I mean, I don't condone hunting at all, ever. But the hunting I really don't condone is the trophy hunting.
Yeah, that's fucked up.
It is. It's all about ego. And
just a tad.
Just a tad.
Yeah, I want to put that head up on the wall,
yeah.
Tell all my friends and get the photo opportunity. So did wolves have a special place in your heart from earlier in your life, or did this really get sparked by that trip into that shop when you saw the wolf pelts?
They weren't really on my radar in terms of a species that I would have expected to write about. But on the other hand, very interesting situation. A couple days ago, my husband brought a box of files in from the garage that, you know, we moved into this house 10 years ago and I hadn't looked at them in 10 years. And I was looking through a couple of the old folders with that I'd labeled personal, you know, just things that I'd kept that had had meaning to me. And I read this letter that was written in the early 80s. It was a letter of recommendation written on my behalf by one of my professors at Humboldt to a graduate program in Northern Michigan at Michigan Tech. And the letter was addressed to the leading wolf researcher at that university. So apparently at that time in my life, and I don't remember it at all, I was looking into graduate studies on wolves of Isle Royale.
Fascinating. And you don't remember it.
I do not remember it. But the other weird circle that comes back is this gentleman whose name is Rolf Peterson just published a new book on the wolves of Isle Royale, and I just bought it about 2 weeks ago. The wolves were seeking me, apparently, and I wasn't necessarily aware of it.
Yes, they weren't done with you.
No, not by a long shot.
No. They were like, you almost slipped away there.
And then another connection to Michigan Tech. When I was in grad school, I went to grad school in Corvallis, and I was thinking about, I'd finished a master's program, or was finishing, thinking about going on to a PhD program. And my advisor had a contact at Michigan Tech in the botany department. And I was in consultation with this professor at Michigan Tech about a PhD program looking at lichens on Isle Royale. So I have to go there, apparently. I've never been. So for some reason, I have to go up there because it keeps coming back and coming back and coming back.
Yeah, it's funny how those things happen, huh?
And those wolves are really in trouble. I think they were down to single digits.
Oh, man.
On the island. Yeah, and they're getting ready to do a reintroduction program there. And then there's Colorado. I mean, the whole story is so twisted. Colorado just voted to reintroduce wolves. And who's going to protect them? There's no more Endangered Species Act protection. So it's going to be up to the state to be smart. And so far, none of them have.
Yeah.
California's been pretty good. California has a state-level Endangered Species Act. And the wolves that are coming into California from Oregon are being protected.
But maybe you should go into wolf time and let them know. Go to California.
Everybody go to California.
Everybody go to California. There's a beach. They'll love it. So tell me a little bit about your shamanic life. How did you get pulled into shamanism?
Good question, too, because I was kind of brought up as a scientist. I did both my undergrad and graduate work in science programs, and my career with the National Park Service was always very science-oriented. And it was Hank Wesselman's Spirit Walker trilogy got my attention.
Right? Didn't it?
It did.
Yes.
And for years, I thought, I'd like to go and study with Hank Wesselman. But I didn't, and I didn't, and I didn't. And then I had a life-changing event when I fell off of a horse and broke my back.
Oh.
And while I was recovering from that, sitting in my big recliner, there were several things that came to me. Actually, I listened to a Carolyn Mace series of tapes that she had produced called Advanced Energy Anatomy.
It must have been a while ago if they were tapes.
Well, I think it was a tape. It's a long time ago. Anyway, and she talked about manifesting things and how an idea starts, comes into your head, travels down to your feet through all your chakras, and then grounds, and then comes back up. And in order to manifest, it has to do that full journey through you. And as I was thinking about that, there were several things that I hadn't done in my life that I wanted to do. And one was to write a book about my experiences in Yosemite, which I ended up doing. And the other,
check.
The other, there were two more. One was to study equine therapy with a woman in Arizona named Linda Kohanoff. Did that. And the other was to study with Hank. Did that. So it was the driver. And I think I was 47.
When you started studying with Hank?
Well, when my back, 2008, so I was 48 when I started studying with Hank and Jill. Yeah. At Esalen started at Esalen.
And so how do you use your practice now? Or is it just something that's sort of there in the sidelines, or are you actively engaged with a shamanic practice?
It's actually become a part of my everyday life in many respects. And I do the actual directed healing work that I do is largely with the animals that we have on the property, and then with the animals as a whole, you know, like doing work on behalf of the wolves. I have started to do more directed journey work because I'm working on a new book.
Oh, you are?
Yes. And it's going to be similar to Wolf Time, different species. It's going to be Sage McAllister will reappear, and some of her compatriots.
So you're doing a series, huh?
I'm doing a series. And this is actually a series that came into my head a long, long time ago. And I didn't ever know how it would manifest. But it's probably been, almost 20 years.
So it's got to take the trip all the way down to your toes. Yes. And then back up again.
Yes.
So yeah, you can. Yeah. Nice.
And I had planned, you know, I had planned on writing another book in the series shortly after I finished Wolf Time, but I couldn't get any traction. I tried this species. No, that didn't work. I tried that species. No, I couldn't focus. No, and back and forth and around. And it wasn't until Wolf Time was published that I could get back into the groove and start working on another species.
So what species called to you?
It's African lions.
Oh, beautiful. You know, in my practice, big cats have been coming through for women like crazy in the last couple of years.
Oh, you just gave me chills.
Lots of jaguars, lots of lions, mountain lions, leopards, cheetahs, all of them.
I've been spending as much time as I can in Africa over the last couple of years.
No kidding.
Yeah, yeah. And I was in Kenya in October, November of 2019. And we were in the Land Cruiser, and I was sitting in the, so there's the driver and the passenger seat in the front, and then there's three bench seats behind that. And I was in the front, first row behind the driver, and the window was down, and we had come across three lions, two females and a male, and they were laying down, and he told me that the male was a very famous lion. We were in the Maasai Mara in Kenya. And this was a lion named Scarface. And he...
I think I've heard about that lion.
It's possible. He's about 13 or 14 years old. He's been a patriarch. And he's got one eye that's been badly damaged.
He's got a scarred face,
yeah.
Hence the name. See, college pays off, kids. Stay in school.
Anyway, so they're laying down not too far from the road. And our driver, Henry, says, let's pull around to the upper road. There's, you know, a road that wrapped around up above where the lions were. And he said, they'll probably get up if they get up at all. They might just sleep. But if they get up, they'll probably head up this direction. And we're like, okay. So we went up and parked the vehicle. And sure enough, they got up. And one of the females was in the lead. And then Scarface, who was limping heavily, and then the second female, they walked right up to the vehicle. The female passed behind the vehicle. The male, Scarface, walked right up to my window. My window is down, and I've got my long lens on my camera, and I can no longer focus it because he's so close.
Wow.
And I had my other camera in the pocket behind the seat with a small wide-angle lens, and I was frozen. I couldn't even grab it to take the shot because he was so close, I didn't know if he was going to actually come right into the vehicle with me.
Mm-hmm.
But he came up and he stopped. We made eye contact. And I said, okay, the lion book is next.
I got it. Check.
Yeah.
Well, I'll start writing right away.
Exactly. I was supposed to be back there this time this year in Kenya, but COVID.
Yeah, it's a pandemic. Who knew?
You just can't predict the global pandemics, can you?
Surprise. Wow. I'm psyched that you're writing. And I'm actually psyched that you're writing fiction, because the power of story, it's potent, because it's a lot less in your face. It's a really subtle way to deliver a message, a really important message, in a way that's palatable to the reader, instead of being lectured at, you know, like in a nonfiction book, or getting somebody in that real cerebral mode where they're engaged with thinking too much about the material. Mm-hmm. A story, you dive into it and you become a part of it, and it becomes a lot more personal and therefore a lot more emotional. And I really think that that's how we can create change, is through story. Do you remember in our 2012 training, when I met you, that one of our exercises was to discover the new myth? Mm-hmm. Is this at all related to that seed that was planted during that training?
I would not have made that connection, but it is. It's about establishing a new paradigm for how we interface with the rest of the world. And it's critical. And I think a lot of people think we've already pushed past the tipping point of being able to manifest great change in the way we do things, and that it will be forced upon us. And some people view the pandemic as being one aspect of that, you know, that our interactions with wildlife, the wet markets in Asia, and continuing to trophy hunt, continuing to intrude on habitat and not allow any habitat for the other species, that the planet is not able to tolerate us anymore.
Yeah, well put. So again, I'm really excited that you're writing and that you're putting these really powerful messages into story form. And I'm really thankful that you were willing to come on and chat with me about all your adventures. What is a good way for folks to get a hold of you?
Facebook is pretty easy. I have a website, www.barbarajmorich.com.
I will put a link in the show notes.
Okay, good. Good. Yeah, those are the two best ways.
Awesome. Well, Barbara, it's been great to reconnect with you. It's been like a little reunion, and for a wonderful reason. You have a new book.
I do have a new book, yes.
Perhaps you can come back on again when you put the second book out.
That would be wonderful. And I'm realizing, you know, I turned 60 this year, and I don't have another 50 years to write books about 50 different species or 25 different species. So I have to get a little faster.
Yeah, writing can be, it's quite a discipline. And writing fiction versus, because it sounds like your other books were nonfiction, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Writing fiction's a whole different animal.
It's much more fun.
It is a lot more fun. Yeah.
Indeed.
Well, thank you.
You're very welcome.
It's tough not to get a wee bit angry on behalf of our wolf friends. If you'd like to get a copy of Barbara's new book, Wolf Time, please visit her website, barbarajmorich.com. Thank you for listening. I'll be back with another thought-provoking episode in a few weeks. Until next time.